Hey, good morning, everybody. This is KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Coming up here, we have a brand new episode of the West Marin Naturalist Hour with our guest in studio here. But first, a little message from Cabaline. Country Emporium and Saddlery, the first certified green business in West Marin, purveyor of outdoor adventures and travel essentials since 1978. Cabaline offers natural, sustainably produced clothing and footwear and also supplies for horses and pets. Open every day on Main Street in Point Reyes Station. And then the number is 415-663-8303. That's 415-663-8303. Pay him a visit on Main Street. Okie dokie. Real quick, we're going to play our intro song and we'll be talking to you all shortly. Okay, top of the morning to you all. This is the West Marin Naturalist Hour. Dallas and Liz, can you hear me out the way at a trailhead? You guys there?
Absolutely. Can you guys hear us?
Yeah. Coming in great. Where are you both located?
We are at the Palo Marin Trailhead this morning. We're going to do a three-day backpacking trip in the seashore. And so our guests are going to meet us a little later so we can be here on the radio this morning.
Awesome. Well, man's back together, although you two are a couple miles away, and here we go. Finally, we get a new episode in. I feel like we had a few cancellations.
We just come up with some of our folks, you know, which is, this is the time of the year where life happens, so.
Yeah, totally.
Super, super excited to have Isaiah on today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you want to tell us what the weather's going to be doing coming up here?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So as of right now, it's nice and windy out here, but it's nice and sunny, too. And it looks like it's going to stay sunny and windy through Wednesday. The wind was supposed to die down after Wednesday, but the sunshine should stick around through the weekend.
That would be nice.
Yeah. It would be nice, right? Our high temperatures will be in the low to mid-70s, actually, through Wednesday. And then it'll cool down just a bit, and then the highs will be in the mid-60s for the weekend. And our lows will be in the mid-50s at nighttime pretty much the entire time.
Okay.
And then if you're heading out for the water, tides for Marshall, California today, our next low tide is 0.5 feet at 1 p.m. today, and our next low tide is 4.6 feet at 7:36. I'm sorry, that was the next high tide. and now I'll pass it off to Liz and introduce today's guest.
Sweet.
Thanks, guys. Our guest today is Isaiah Thalmayer. He's the restoration director for the Straw Program at Point Blue, and his work focuses on developing and implementing restoration projects and cultivating partnerships and collaboration. He works closely with the Resource Conservation District's tribal partners, land managers, K through college students, and other groups to design and implement restoration projects that directly benefit wildlife and human communities. He's been around the Straw team since 2011. And what else do we have to say about this guy? He grew up in the Siskiyou Mountains of Southern Oregon and earned his BS at Warren Wilson College, a work college in Asheville, North Carolina, and an MS from the University of California, Davis. Welcome to the show, Isaiah.
Welcome.
Good friend.
Yeah, nice.
Thanks so much, y'all. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you could come into the studio. It's always it's so much more fun when the guest gets to come in. And So where do we start here? Yeah, that was quite a bio there. I guess we can start how you got into doing environmental work. Like what brought you to this path you're on and this career you are doing right now?
Sure. Yeah. Like y'all mentioned, thank you for the very generous bio intro there. I grew up in Southern Oregon. I grew up kind of out in the boonies, not too dissimilar from, say, West Marin here, except we didn't have a bustling metropolitan area just over the hill. So it was the proper boonies. But, you know, the benefits of that is that I got to grow up running around outside. That was kind of the only thing to do in that part of the world. So I spent a lot of time playing in the creek and playing with sticks and rocks and plants and all that good stuff. And
forced to be outdoors, huh?
Forced to be outdoors, yeah. But I'm so grateful that I was, because it certainly instilled a deep appreciation for time spent outdoors. Yeah. And as I grew up and learned more about, you know, work and career stuff and all of that, it just became clear that there was a lot of opportunity to do good by that natural world. It needed a lot of help out there. And so I was fortunate to be able to kind of go in a direction that led me to this career in habitat restoration. I started as an organic farmer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. And my family, you know, are vegetable farmers too. So I kind of had that in my history as well. But yeah, the combination of that and then, you know, kind of appreciation for botany in particular really helped tee up a career in restoration science, which brings those things together, right? So you're propagating native plants to do restoration. And so it's a lot of those similar skills.
I never made that connection before. Yeah, like organic farming and also restoration work. Yeah, you're kind of promoting and caretaking for certain plant species and helping it to survive and thrive. That makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, nice. And
how'd you find it?
Go ahead, Dallas.
Sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, also talk a little bit about Point Blue, because, you know, you're working with Point Blue. How'd you end up finding Point Blue?
Yeah, great question. So after I graduated from college, I moved back to this area, and I was, you know, fresh out of college. It was kind of similar, actually, to I feel for college students these days, because when I was graduating in 2011 from my undergrad, there was, you know, the headlines of the day were like, the job market is terrible, good luck out there kind of a stuff. And so that was the same job market that I was entering into. But anyways, I ended back up in this area. I wanted to be on the West Coast, and it took me a little while to settle. But I ended up finding an internship at Point Blue Conservation Science. At that time, it was called PRBO. So if you're familiar with the org, you might know it even as Point Reyes Bird Observatory. That's how it got started in 1965.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a
original
name. Huh.
Yep. And at that time, it was located down at the field station in Bolinas, which is still there. And so that's where the org got its history, really pioneering bird monitoring. Birds are wonderful indicator species of ecosystem health, as you all know. And at that time, especially, there was a lot of cool work going on in this area, kind of developing the methodology, like how do we study birds and how do we use them as indicators for ecosystem health? And so a big part of that work was rooted here in West Marin County. And the Point Reyes Bird Observatory were big leaders in that. And a big part of that was not only monitoring birds, but monitoring them over a really long time scale. So having data that can show kind of how are birds responding, not just this month, this year, but over years, and being able to correlate that to things that people do, things that the climate are doing, to really understand what the impacts and feedbacks are there.
I will say, one of the things I've noticed, you know, in Point Blue and a lot of the work and research that's being done there is this value on long, which we has actually been a running theme on our show, and we realize the importance of these long-term data sets. And it seems like Point View really values that, and has not just with birding, but other aspects like intertidal zone work and things like that.
Absolutely.
As well. Yeah. So I always really appreciated about that is that your long-term data sets you have, because that can inform so much policy and decision making. And
totally. It represents work from so many people over many, many years to collect those and curate, analyze those. So they really are, they're huge, like, boons to, you know, to all of us as far as answering those long-term questions. So they're really incredibly valuable in that way.
Yeah, especially in a period where, you know, climate conditions are changing fast, and it's good to have those long-term data sets to compare things to.
Yeah.
And then also, like, as a private organization, like, you're not as much at the whim of who's in government at different times, right? Like, there's other ways to find the funding and whatnot to support those efforts, even if it's not supported by the administration.
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Liz, because, you know, we are a nonprofit organization, which means we fundraise in a variety of ways. We definitely rely on public funding, both in the form of, like, contracts and grants, federal and state. So you're so right that we're really fortunate to live in a state that is pretty progressive and, you know, puts its money where its mouth is as far as doing work on climate and conservation. So all that said, you know, Point Blue does hold some federal funding as well. And so we weren't exactly 100% sheltered from the changes that we are all experiencing, you know, with this administration. But we are maybe a bit more insulated than some of our partner organizations. But it's been a wild time. And right. So we've had to pivot to other sources, definitely get creative. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really important to have a diversity of funding, including private donations that can help us kind of ride out these hard times. But it's a wild time to be in this field. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Totally, and we usually push it, you know, towards the end and remind people to donate, but this is a good time to remind people now, too, that people can donate to Point Blue Conservation Science while we're talking about it.
They sure can. Thank you, Dallas. And you know, we're really totally fortunate to be beneficiaries of this awesome community for many decades, so here's a shout-out to all y'all who have supported us already.
It is nice living in a community that values, you know, open spaces, conservation efforts, and that I'm sure that definitely helps.
It does.
And Point Blue covers quite the gamut of both research and conservation work.
Yeah.
I think the last time we had anyone from Point Blue on our show, I can't remember when, maybe Dallas Lins, maybe you do, but it was over a year ago. And I think it was the bird research done at the observatory in Bolinas.
Renee Cormier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Renee Cormier.
Wonderful. She's actually my neighbor in Second Valley.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah.
But what's the kind of range of work you do in Point Blue? Because there's visiting your website, there's a lot of things you're involved in.
Absolutely, yeah. Great question. So I kind of mentioned like the org's history, founded in bird research, and there's definitely still a lot of that going. There's that through line through much of our work, but that's not the only thing Point Blue works on. We also have a really robust working lands team that focuses on doing conservation work with agricultural producers.
Oh, really?
And a lot of those folks are actually placed in NRCS office, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. So they're titled partner biologists, and they kind of fill a unique role of working with federal dollars, but helping local ranchers kind of all over the state do projects that have benefits to wildlife. So that's one example of something that's bird adjacent, but quite different, actually.
Yeah.
So that's one team. There's folks who work, this is bird related, I must confess, but bigger than just West Marin. There's people who work on the Pacific Flyway, which is a really incredible, you know, migratory route that birds fly from North to South America all the way down as far as like the very tippy southern tip of South America. And so there's folks kind of stationed all along that flyway, including as far south as Antarctica, doing research down there. We also have a big like climate and kind of informatics team that does really cool stuff around soil carbon, big data sets. They've done a lot of work figuring out behind the scenes systems to house all this data. We at Point Blue, we hold the records, the data, the bird data, not only for our org, but for a lot of orgs across the country. And that's all compiled and publicly accessible. And so the infrastructure, you know, to house all that, to curate that, is managed by Point Blue. And so there's a whole team focused on that. And last but not least, I should mention the team that I work for, the Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed team, or STRAW. That's yet another program at Point Blue.
And we'll definitely get into that one, too. Yeah. But and back to the data, capturing so much data is only part of the game here. You got to synthesize that data and make it compatible, make it useful. And I can't imagine that's an easy project.
It's a lot of work. It sure is.
And don't you do a lot of work in the Farallon Islands, too?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had a long-term kind of research team stationed out there basically every day of the year. I should know this off the top of my head, but I believe it's since the late 60s. So yet another really long-term data set out there. It's not just birds, although birds are a big component of what's monitored, but also, marine mammals, sharks, mm-hmm. Lots of like abiotic stuff like sea temperatures and all of that. Mm-hmm. So that's a really incredible and unique data set that exists out there. And that, of course, has been in partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages the National Wildlife Refuge that includes the Farallon Islands.
Okay, yeah.
Such a special place out there.
It sure is. I got to work out there once a long time ago now. I spent a little bit more than a week out there pulling an invasive plant called New Zealand spinach. But it was one of the funnest weeks of my life, honestly. It's a pretty unique place to be. So that
I've
was definitely
I've never been
true.
Out there. Yeah. I've yet to...
It's rugged. It's yeah. windswept.
Yeah.
But it's an incredible yeah. view of the coast. You know, you kind of see the San Francisco skyline poking in and out of the fog, and you feel so close but so far away from it all.
That would be an interesting perspective, seeing the coastline from out there and looking back yeah. on what's out here. Huh. I thought of it that way. Yeah.
I had the opportunity to help Point Blue on a supply run a number of years ago out to the Farallons, and it was, so close but so far away. And
I will say, you know, Point Blue, like the amount of stuff that y'all do. I remember when the switch happened when the name switched from Point Reyes Birding Observatory to Point Blue. It was like, oh, it felt so appropriate because it's so much more than birds nowadays.
And then Point Reyes.
Exactly. So, you know, it's pretty amazing the work y'all do.
Well, thank you.
And we didn't get a chance to come. Yeah, totally. And let's talk more about straw because that's been one of my favorite programs, you know, and. How did it get started? Tell us a little bit more about STRAW.
Yeah. So STRAW stands for Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed, and it's now a program of Point Blue. We became teamed up with Point Blue in 2011, but it actually got started back in 1992 right here in Marin County. And it was started by a teacher at the time, a fourth grade teacher at Brookside Elementary in San Anselmo. Her name is Lorette Rogers, and she still works with us today. But at that time, as a fourth grade teacher, her class was curious about endangered species. The story goes they watched a really depressing video about endangered species, and then
which one?
I wish I knew the name of the video. It was probably one of those standard issue kind of educational materials at the time, you know. Right. But a student raised their hand afterwards, you know, somewhat depressed, and was like, what do we do? How can we help these critters, you know? And at that time, project-based learning was kind of a big approach to education in the state system. And so as a class, they undertook this project-based learning project to figure out how to help. In this case, it was the California freshwater shrimp, which is a really unique, actually, endemic species that we have around here. And that was the endangered species that the class kind of adopted to take care of and learn about. And if you don't know about that animal already, check them out. They're pretty cool. They only exist in about 30 streams worldwide, and they're all here in the North Bay.
Oh, really?
And
if you
think about, like, you know, whatever, aquatic macroinvertebrates, as we call them, you know, like water critters and things like that, you might think of, like, all the little creepy crawly stuff that's in the stream. Well, these guys are actually, they're really a cut above. They're about the size of my pinky finger. So they're pretty
darn
large.
Oh, so they're not like
large.
Brine shrimp here.
They're not like brine shrimp, exactly. They're not like sea monkeys. They're full-fledged shrimp.
Oh.
They're pretty cool animals in that way. And they only live in fresh water, and they really, really need the roots of trees like willows and alders to hold on to. They're not great swimmers. And so they need that, especially during flood events, to be able to kind of hang out and persist those high flows. So the class figured out that the best way to do right by this species was actually to do habitat restoration for them, because a lot of the streams that they still existed in didn't have those riparian trees that they used to. But what's really cool about the story is at that same time, there was also an effort going on in the northern part of Marin County in the Stemple Creek watershed, which is a whole lot of privately held land mostly up there, a lot of agriculture going on, and the local Water Resource Control Board, kind of the regulatory body that helps make sure we have clean water in the state. They were really focused on that watershed and some of the pathogens that were coming out of that watershed. And this is something that's pretty typical across the state. There's these things called TMDLs, total maximum daily loads. And it's essentially the way, it's the threshold at which they regulate. You know, they say, okay, if we're polluted above this point.
Is it like bacteria level? Or?
Exactly, yeah. Things like fecal coliform. There's different kinds of TMDLs. They exist for sediment, for example, as well as pathogens. So that watershed was exceeding its total maximum daily load, which basically meant it was on their radar for regulation. And usually what that means, you know, is some sort of kind of punitive system, fines and things like that. But in this case, the alternative that producers in the area were also kind of presented with was doing habitat restoration, because planting those trees and plants along creeks, not only do they help critters like the freshwater shrimp, but they also do wonders in actually filtering the runoff that comes off the land, cleaning that water. And so in kind of a unique partnership between...
Much like a wetland does.
Exactly. Yep. So this really awesome partnership between producers, ranchers in that area, and environmentalists, and these fourth graders emerged in the early 90s, where they went all in on habitat restoration. And it was just a couple ranchers who initially took it on. Paul Martin, Al Poncha, the late Al Poncha, a couple early adopters up in the Stemple Creek watershed. We're eternally grateful to them and their families. But they essentially helped us show, you know, hey, like, if we do this work on the landscape, if we let a class of fourth graders come on and plant a whole bunch of native trees, not only can we create habitat for this critically endangered species, but we can clean up our waterways. We can actually help the ranchers meet their needs as far as water quality goes as well. So the rest is kind of history. They did that for one year.
Win-win-win. Kind of a serendipitous collaboration there.
Exactly. Yeah. It was so powerful for Lorette and her students. Lorette actually, after a year or two more of teaching, she decided to go out on her own and create this program. And now, you know, about 30, almost 35 years later, we serve about 160 teachers every year. We work with more than 4,000 students from across the Bay Area. This past season, we planted over 20,000 native plants across a whole bunch of sites across the whole state of California.
Oh, cool.
And this is all, you know, free to teachers and students. So it's something that if they're interested, they can sign up with us to get involved. And
wow. And I think with those numbers, I think I read it was about 15 different counties that this is happening in.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd say the Bay Area is still kind of our core geography, but we have projects as far east as the Sierra. We've been doing some work up in the Southern Cascade, up kind of in Plumas County, doing mountain meadow restoration up there, which is really cool. And we have a new statewide program, which has taken us a little bit farther and wider than we had in the past. So that's been wonderful to work down in like San Luis Obispo County a little bit and up north. So,
Well, how does it work with a school getting in, like, if they were interested, getting involved starting one of these projects?
Absolutely. A great way to get involved is just to reach out to us. You know, we really recognize and respect teachers as being expert educators, especially in their communities, knowing their community best. So we never want to prescribe this to anyone. So it's really, it's voluntary. It's up to teachers, you know, who are interested and also, you know, have the bandwidth to take this on. They're busy people as well. But if you're interested, you can just reach out to me or anyone on our team. Our education director, Gina Graziano, is a wonderful person to get in contact with. So if you end up reaching out to me, I can connect you with her. But it's just a way to kind of get in our queue. And we kind of offer anything from lessons to full on more of like field trip options where students come and plant with us in the field. So there's kind of a range of options depending on how teachers would like to get involved.
Yeah.
We had West Marine
School. That's really great that there's like a spectrum of ways to be involved and not like... like you were saying, like a prescribed thing that they have to sign up for the whole semester. They can do that, but then there's also these other opportunities.
Absolutely. We try to meet teachers where they're at, recognizing they're busy.
Yeah, and that flexibility is important, especially when they're, you know, have a career. You know, if I'm sure a lot of them are trying to fit it into like a curriculum that they're supposed to teach. I'm curious on some examples of projects going on, especially locally here.
Sure.
Some of the work that's being done with straw here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's hard, honestly, to drive around the back roads around here without driving past an old straw project, which is kind of fun. You know, we've worked all over the place at this point. A lot of work, especially in the northern part of the county. So Stemple Creek watersheds, Estero Americano, that area. We've got quite a few projects around the town of Tamales these days. But like just driving up Highway 1 from here, you know, you'll pass by Millerton Ranch. We've done a project there. We've done a number of projects on the Blake's Landing Farm, the core Strauss dairy there, as well as Strauss Home Ranch, Razor Ranch, the Brazil Ranch. I mentioned the Ponchas. We've done a number of projects on various parcels they own, Moretti Dairy up in Tamales.
And kind of the core project would be planting native species along the creek?
Absolutely, yeah. Creeks? In this area, a lot of the focus is on riparian projects, planting along streams and creeks. Those are areas that have really high benefit for wildlife. Yeah. And also, especially around here, like in some of the more core, heavily used agricultural areas, like, for example, near like historic dairies, sometimes those creeks can have taken a little bit of a beating over the years. So they're prime opportunities for doing some revegetation and restoration. Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of the ranches are pretty stoked about that too, right? It's a win-win situation.
Absolutely, yeah. And we really try to identify projects that that landowners and producers want themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So like in order for something to be successful, it absolutely has to integrate with whatever land management they're doing on site. It's got to work for their production. So like a great example of that is like if we're looking at a project where we're thinking about restoring a creek, a big component of that is often either, you know, updating the fencing or building some sort of fencing to help keep the cows out so that the native plants can establish. And a big part of that, too, might require, like, installing a new water trough or some way to kind of allow the cows to still have access to water. Maybe historically they were just accessing it in the stream. So there's a number of kind of practices we do alongside the restoration planting that support it but are really important, especially for landowners. And those, I should mention, we do in really close collaboration with awesome partners at the Marin Resource Conservation District, the Marin RCD, and also sometimes folks like MALT and NRCS are also partners in those projects.
I was wondering about that. Yeah. If some of the other larger land management agencies out here are involved.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. We're a really tight-knit community. Thankfully, it takes a team in that way. And, you know, if we're meeting, if not every week, like every month, we have kind of we call it the A team, which stands for acronym team, because we're all saddled with acronyms in our name. But we get together and we kind of touch base on all these projects and see how we can help.
It's amazing how, especially, you know, I've worked in the nonprofit world. How much acronyms are such a part of the nonprofit world?
They are.
Also, the outdoor world.
Just the world in general, I suppose. Yeah, and any sort of, I mean, you can always find a good, like, you know, acronym to liven things up. Really gets a project going. having an appropriate acronym. So we're getting to that point where we should probably take a quick break here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the West Marin Naturalist Hour on KWMR. We are with Isaiah Tallmar. Did I pronounce your last name correct? And we're talking about restoring watersheds, some of the projects that Point Blue does with in Straw with youth restoring watersheds. And any Dallas Liz, any quick words you want to add before we go to break here?
No, we'll go over a few things after break.
All right, sounds good. Well, I'm gonna play a song I'm kind of into right now. It's called Sky Tide by Ronald Jenkins, and we'll be back after that.
All right.
Oh, boy. We are back. This is the Westburn Naturalist Hour on KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. And we are talking about restoring watersheds with children through a program called Straw at Point Blue with Isaiah Talmar. We got your last name right, right? Yes. Okay. But before we do that, real quick thing. I got a couple messages for you all. One from the Marin Symphony. KWMR is underwritten by the Marin Symphony, presenting live classical musical concerts each fall through spring. Chamber performances are held at various venues throughout Marin County. More information at marinsymphony.org or by phone at 415-479-8100. And also a message from the Jane M. Geischer Foundation. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But KWMR is written by the Jane M. Geischer Foundation, by its listeners, and by this foundation. Thank you for ongoing support of West Marin Community Radio. And we thought you should know that. Dallas and Liz, you want to start us off over there? Sorry, I actually accidentally hung up on you guys, but you called back.
That's okay.
We got back in time to hear the jam.
Yeah, all right,
that's
sweet.
Nice room for a Monday.
Yeah, I like thought so, that. Too. Little Ronald Jenkins, he's one of my new favorite producers.
Excellent. Yeah. We have like a two-part question. So what does your day-to-day kind of look like, Isaiah, for work? And then also, what does a typical day look like when you have students in the field?
Oh, yeah. Fun question. Okay. So day-to-day, well, I feel really fortunate where every day is quite different in my neck of the woods. So I get a lot of variety, which keeps it interesting and keeps it fun, especially after – you know, almost 15 years at it. But, you know, TBH, a lot of my day does involve a computer these days. So,
of course. Yeah.
There's quite a lot of screen time. But a lot of that is spent connecting with people. So that helps it, you know, helps things go by a little bit quicker. But, yeah, I'm on the phone. I'm on meetings quite a lot. A whole lot of coordination goes on behind the scenes to kind of identify these projects, plan them out, implement them over time. So, yeah, that's a big part of it. I'm also working with our team. I work with about 11 other folks who are focused on doing restoration in this area and propagating plants. So, you know, a lot of coordination goes into just keeping everyone going. Honestly, it's me trying to keep up with them. I'm really lucky to work with a super productive, high-powered team. So that's a whole lot of fun. But, yeah, it's a lot of people time. And then I'd say the other side of it is getting out in the field. So, like, this time of the year, we're working on identifying and designing all the projects that we're going to implement in the coming fall and winter. We like to do the planting when it's raining outside, when the soil's wet. And so right now, what we're doing is going around to a bunch of potential project sites and kind of envisioning with the landowner and partners what it could look like. And then we start to hone in on actual design. So that's really fun because it gets me outside. Yeah. It gets me kind of thinking years into the future, you know, not only like what this place will look like after a couple years of planting, but 20, 30, 50 years down the road when these plants are mature, kind of what's the vision for this place. So yeah. That's a really fun stage as well. Yeah. And then as far as a day with students, so what that looks like is that work usually happens. We have students come and help us during the planting phase of most projects. So, again, that's kind of like fall, winter, spring, which is great because that's when students are in school. So they'll pile on a bus or a bunch of parent cars, and they'll come out essentially like a field trip. So they'll show up, you know, about 9 in the morning. We'll meet them. Oftentimes it's pretty rural site, so they've had quite an adventure getting out there,
sure.
You know, seeing some new back roads. They'll pile off the bus. We get everyone kind of warmed up with a few different circles that cover everything from safety, what to expect, to the technical stuff of like how you do the planting. And that can be pretty technical. We really, these are professional level projects and we don't cut any corners with them. So we make sure that, you know, they know how to do every single step of whatever they're doing, everything from like putting the plant in the ground. But there's all these important kind of supporting practices, like putting a seed basket and or a cage around it to make sure that they don't get the plants don't get eaten by gophers or deer while they're establishing. We have, you know, various different ways of kind of using like erosion control fabric to prevent weeds from growing back. Mm. So, and students can do all of that. So we'll train them up. They'll work for about 2 to 3 hours. We'll take a big lunch break. We do a couple, kind of like educational circles where, you know, we ask them questions and they give us some good feedback, and then they pile in their vehicles and head out for the day.
And how old are they? What's the age range? You might have mentioned it, but I can't remember.
So it really runs the gamut from kindergarten up through 12th grade, even, you know, college, community college students as well.
Oh, really?
I'd say the majority, probably around a little bit more than 50%, is in that like second to sixth grade range. It's particularly easier, I should say, to coordinate with a single teacher. When students go to middle and high school, they end up in
various classes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that gets a little trickier. We still do it, but yeah.
Oh, wow. And I mean, there's such a value on all levels for this, right?
Absolutely.
Like the student, I mean, I'm such a huge fan of like experiential learning.
Yep.
And I can think of back in my childhood, the moments, especially in the outdoor world, that really stuck with me. Are you know, I still have those memories like locked in my head. I know we've jokingly talked about my owl pellet experience, but there, I can think of a number of moments just like you know that are like these prominent memories that drew me to the outdoors. And you're creating that for all these kids, you know, on all sorts of different levels.
Yeah.
And then also just the benefits of the watershed, and then the benefits to the just the community at large with cleaner water and the ranchers. It's just like it seems like such a win-win-win.
It really is. Yeah. It totally is. And, you know, it's so empowering to get to be involved in that way, you know.
Yeah.
We work with students in classes from really all over the place. So that includes, you know, it's like occasionally some private schools, but a whole lot of public schools, including from places who maybe don't get exposed to as many experiences like
this. I was
like
going to ask about that, yeah.
So, like, it's not uncommon at all for us to, like, be in the field and we'll hear some kid shriek and we're like, oh, no, something happened. And then we look over and they're holding an earthworm in their hands, you know, and maybe they've never seen that before. And it's such a powerful experience. Just those little things that it's easy for the rest of us to take for granted. They're having those first experiences and memories, like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so important for that to be fostered. And it's just like in the age we live in where especially youth are bombarded with technology and social media, anything learning experiential-wise that can be like, you know, not contradictory to that, but like to combat that kind of addiction, really, to those things. It's so good. Dulce Liz, it's hard to know when I'm used to making eye contact with you too. Feel free to chime in.
I know. It's tough being on the phone, but no, you're all good. You're all good. No, and we're feeling the same way. And it's like
we're just over here inspired, and
I'm feeling inspired. And it just makes me know think of the quote that we get to almost every episode, the Baba Dayan quote again. It's like, in the end, we'll conserve only what we love. We'll love only what we understand. We'll understand only what we're taught. You know, and you're getting all these kids to come out there and teaching them this young and having them do this like professional projects. It's so inspiring.
Absolutely, that's such a great quote.
Yeah, and the feeling that like you're actually making a difference too, right? It's not you're not just learning about it; you're making a difference.
Yeah.
Totally.
And tangible. It's a very tangible.
That's the word
project.
I'm looking for. Yeah.
Totally. And you're talking about, you know, going to these projects and dreaming, and that's so exciting. And, you know, you've been doing these projects for so long, you know, what's some long-term changes that you've seen from these projects that were planted, like, in the beginning?
That's a great question.
Yeah, great question. That's one of my favorite things to do. The rare opportunities I kind of do is get to, you know, tour some of the older sites. Well, actually, I say rare, but actually it's not terribly uncommon, like I mentioned. Certain parts of the county you drive around and the projects are so big at this point, you can see them from the road, you know. So that's pretty incredible. So, yeah, a lot of what we see, say, after 10 years, we start to see the trees looking like trees. You know, they're not little shrubby things. They're sticking up over the grasses. At 20 years, they're really looking like trees. You know, they're as tall as your house. And then some of our oldest projects that are 30, 35 years old, they're like they almost look like they were always there, you know, which is really what we're going for some ways. They're pretty much fully recovered, and they just look like another patch of creek that's been wild the whole time. So it does take quite a lot of time for these things to get established and to develop. You know, plants are slow growing, especially some of the ones that we love to plant, like oak trees and things like that, are particularly slow growing. But give them time, and they'll really do it.
Yeah.
It takes a while, and sometimes, you know, especially like the first couple of years, things can be a little tough, you know, if you get a drought year or something like that. But it's incredible. Plants are so powerful and tenacious. If you can get on their time scale, chances are they're going to really impress you over time. So it's great to go back and see those projects.
That brings another question to mind. We talk about like 1 or 2 years out. Is there maintenance that also goes on? And is that something that like the straw, like more core staff handles, or is that also potentially project based for students to come out and help with?
Or does the farm take it on?
Absolutely. Or does the ranch take it on? Yeah, that's property
question.
Owner.
Yeah, great question. I'm so glad you asked that too, because you're so right. In order for these projects to be successful, maintenance is a really, really critical component. So we always do at least 3 years of maintenance on these projects. So they're multi-year projects. You know, they're kind of like in the 2 to 5 year range. Sometimes we do them a little bit shorter if it's a lighter touch. But our kind of standard approach is 3 years of maintenance, because if you're planting container plants, woody plants, especially in our dry Mediterranean climate, they need a little bit of TLC through the summer in order to really get established. So what that looks like for us...
What's TLC?
Tender love and care.
Tender love and care.
That's right.
Is that what TLC, the those girls from the 90s, was that what they... The like?
Is that what T-Boz, Left Eye, and Chili?
Yeah. Were they TLC for tender love and care? I don't know. Maybe. Anyways.
We'll call it a double entendre, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
So for the plants, what TLC means is, you know, our crew is out there pretty much from March through September giving the plants water every week. And that that either looks like, you know, some kind of extensive irrigation system that we're running and maintaining, or sometimes in more remote places we'll do hand watering. We have water trailers that we tow around. And that is so critical, maybe the most critical thing to keep plants alive in those early years before their roots get deep and can access groundwater. The other big thing we're doing in the maintenance phase is weeding right around the base of the plant, just so things like thistles or things that have the ability to kind of grow fast and outcompete our plants don't threaten them in those first few years. They have cages, I mentioned that, to protect them from deer. So we're making sure all that's in place and functioning well. But then after about 3 or 4 years, the plants are usually really well established at that point.
Take on a resiliency.
And they're big, and they're also tall, so they can get nibbled by deer. They can even get a little nibbled by rabbits, and they'll be fine. So we come back then and remove all that stuff and make sure, kind of set it free so it can continue on its merry way.
Interesting. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Well, I'm going to use that acronym for now on TLC for all sorts of things. think of the possibilities.
Learning so much on this show today.
I know.
I was going to say, you do so much, you know, what's something in your work right now that's like really, really stoked on?
Good question. Okay. God, there's so much. But I think in my role these days, one of the things that I get to think about, which is really fun, is kind of like, what's next for us? Like, what's going to be, what's coming down the pipeline as far as new approaches or techniques to restoration? How can we do what we're doing but do it better, make it more successful in the future? Or what are kind of new types of projects? So within that umbrella, some things that are coming up kind of across the field of restoration that I think are really fascinating and we have the opportunity to do more of in the county. One is this concept called process-based restoration. And this has kind of been around for a while. It's popular in other ecosystems in California. Like, it's an approach to restoration that's been used a lot in Sierra Mountain meadows. And the idea is that you harness natural processes to do a lot of the restoration work for you. So that might mean using things like high flow events to kind of capture sediment and rebuild like the shape of the stream. Oftentimes it uses techniques that are mimicking beavers, which are great ecosystem architects.
Yeah.
Folks out there might have heard about the power that beavers have had on places, you know, like the Midwest, where they're prevalent. Essentially what they do is they block water, you know, they build these dams, they spread water out across the landscape, creates this huge, like, kind of mosaic of aquatic environments that all different kinds of wildlife and plants really rely on. But importantly, especially in a dry place like California, it effectively raises the water table quite significantly. Instead of having, like, an incised stream, you know, like a, especially around here where we have really erosive soils, streams can end up kind of like in a deep ditch, you know? And what happens when the water is running in the bottom of that ditch is all the water that's in the adjacent soil in the pasture, say, next to the stream, drains out because the drain for that is that much lower. It's at the bottom of that ditch. But
oh,
if you
wow.
can imagine if yeah. that stream is brimming over the top with a beaver dam, it's keeping the pasture right next to it wet as well. And that means better grass growth if you're in an agricultural setting. So it can be a little bit messier. You might have a little bit more, like, flow event, say, because the water is higher. So that's kind of the trade-off.
But you're creating a kind of a greater riparian area,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh,
and
wow.
that's that can do wonders. That can achieve things that we can't achieve just by planting plants alone, because you're actually changing kind of the flow and what's called the geomorphology of the stream, the
shape of it. That's really cool. So learn from the beavers and kind of recreate some of what they would do.
Exactly.
Which, by the way, hasn't there been talk of reintroduction of beavers in some of the areas out here? And
yeah.
Any news or thoughts on that?
Sure, yeah. So definitely there's folks who are looking into it. I think there's a whole range of opinions on how successful or detrimental that might be.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that, you know, beavers used to exist kind of across the state, so here as well. And there have been efforts over the years to reintroduce them. I learned recently that they were once reintroduced to the seashore, I think in the 40s.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. There was a reintroduction effort across the state then. And I don't think that they were successful here, but I'll just say it's been tried before. People are looking into it. My understanding is that what they need to be able to persist is really large areas with a whole lot of alders and very few human infrastructure elements that could be impacted.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
As far as I understand, there aren't a whole lot of great areas that have been identified so far in the county that would be suitable for reintroduction.
Yeah, because of development and neighborhoods along the shoreline, and is there so many areas that could be impacted with changing waterways? That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. Roads, all of that. But yeah. I know people are working really hard to try to do that. And in the meantime, there are some pilot projects that have happened. For example, doing what's called beaver dam analog, so kind of people's attempt to do some of the structural work that beavers have done. And my thinking is more along those lines. I think there's a lot of opportunity to do things that kind of mimic beavers or mm-hmm. somehow emulate some of their process-based work, maybe without bringing them back. And in doing so, I think the emulation factor will make it that much more practical to do, say, on some of our working landscapes.
Yeah.
Understandably, some of these projects wouldn't really be possible if we had beavers there because, you know, there's a dairy right next door or there's a Caltrans bridge or something that we couldn't impact. But I think we can kind of reap some of the benefits by doing, for example, some of these beaver dam analogs or in-stream structures without
yeah.
actually having to bring the beavers back, per se.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one example.
Yeah. Oh, that's
interesting.
I'm curious what happened to the beavers in the 40s. If they were reintroduced, what happened?
Yeah.
Did they leave? They get trapped again or what?
That's a great question. You know,
another episode.
If you guys should call up the Occidental Arts and Ecology program. They have a really, really fun beaver focused program there, and they would be great guests to have. Here's a little plug for those guys.
Okay.
Brock Dolman.
All
right. Love it. And we're getting close to the end of the show, so I always want to make sure that people have the opportunity and remind folks, if folks want to donate or get involved, where's the best way for them, or how's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for that question. So if you are inclined to donate or just want to learn more about Point Blue and Straw's work, check us out online, pointblue.org. There's a bunch of helpful information there. There's an easy link for donation. And you can donate to the org overall or check out some of our programs. So I definitely recommend getting on the website and seeing what you can find there. Also, I just want to offer, if anyone is curious to learn more, feel free, absolutely, to reach out to me. I'd love to chat more about this work. You can find my contact info on Point Blue's website as well. And I can mention it here on the website or on the show if that's all right as well. Yeah.
Nice.
Absolutely.
And I'm also really curious, and actually, Dallas, you listed this question. I thought it was great, so I'm going to say it. If there's, like, something that is misunderstood in restoration work or something you wish people understood about just restoration work in general or maybe along watersheds, what would that be?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I want to give it a moment of thought. I mean, a couple of things come to mind, I guess. One is just like the time element, that it takes a long time to do this. And I think another one, too, and this is kind of related perhaps, is just encouraging people to reframe their what they think of as beautiful. And I'm kind of preaching to the choir and the Westmoreland crowd. You know, you drive around here, people have got native plants in their yard, all that. But it's not uncommon to have to kind of convince people that what we're going for is desirable, you know, that like a wild creek is a beautiful creek and things like that. So that's maybe
that's
one,
really interesting. Yeah.
One misconception. The other one I'll throw out there too is sometimes there's misconceptions. You know, we work with volunteers, we work with students, and people love to make jokes around like free labor and all of that. But I hope people can see a little bit beyond that, just to the educational value. And just how all the learning that's involved in this. And also, if you're a nonprofit, if you're a listener out there who's worked with volunteers, you might be chuckling too, because you know it takes just about as much time to get people involved as you can hope to for them to accomplish the volunteers, you know. So it's a labor of love that we do, because that impact on the community is so important to us.
And honestly, I mean, I can see how people can make the joke about free labor, but you're teaching valuable skills that they're going to take on, you know, maybe not in this particular field, but they're, you know, and they're also making like actual connections with the land and environment around them in a way that just cannot be done in a classroom, you know?
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. And it's, you know, at this point, like 35 years in, we're at the stage where like students who came through the program 10, 20 years ago, we're re-meeting them in the workforce. It's pretty incredible.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like it's I could name a couple people who, like, you know, did STRAW as an elementary school, now work for a resource conservation district.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it really is like a full circle kind of impact on the community. And it's so wonderful to see that, like, proof of concept come around, see how it's impacted people's lives.
Yeah. That's awesome. I know we've seen that, especially Dallas and Liz, through the years of, not to speak for you both, but seeing some of the students that had on you know, outdoor kayaking trips, and then seeing them work in the industry and stay with it.
Totally. Now they're full-blown adults, you know, doing good things in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting to be in an industry long enough to really be able to see that happen. And you're such an amazing figure in the industry, so it's so fantastic to have you out here and join us, because this is an episode we've been wanting to have for a long time. So excited about the work you guys do.
And is there anything specific to STRAW, like that, in terms of like support it needs right now, or is it? Are you still looking at growing the program, or where is it standing now overall, and what kind of visions do you see for it for the future?
Yeah, absolutely. We sometimes expand, you know, when the work kind of calls for it. We've taken on a lot of really exciting projects in the last couple years that have helped us access some new geographies and expand a bit. So we're at a good stage now. I would say one thing we always need, if you're so inclined, you know, unrestricted funding, essentially donations that help us seek out new work, like look at new opportunities.
Makes it flexible, right?
Incredibly flexible. That's one of the biggest supports that our team can have. So, yeah, I'll throw that out there in case that rings any bells. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's about that time. We got to wrap up here, but this has been awesome. It's super inspiring what you all are doing, and this STRAW program sounds amazing, and I hope to see it continue to grow and be fostered. And super appreciate the work you're doing, Isaiah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Seamus, Liz, Dallas, thank you so much for having me today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Great to talk with you.
Likewise. Enjoy that trail, y'all. Have a great trip.
Thank you so much. We would have to try hard not to.
All right. Well, we'll be back in a few weeks with a new episode. So we'll see y'all next time, friends. Thanks for tuning in to the Westmoreland Naturalist Hour.